Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, at the Reformed Forum office studio. We've got a real important and exciting conversation lined up for you today. Let me introduce to you our panelists, our co-workers here, our co-laborers today in apologetics. First, we have Carlton Wynn, who serves as a pastor down at Westminster PCA in Atlanta, Georgia. He's also an adjunct professor at RTS Atlanta. Welcome back, Carlton. It's good to see you.
Thanks, Camden. I'm calling in from the land that has seen snow in the last 3 weeks, two times.
Unbelievable. How do you even survive?
It's we bundled up with everything we had, and we scraped off the half inch off the driveway, and we somehow persevered.
Good. Well, we're excited to have you. Really thankful. And we also have with us Dr. Lane Tipton, of course, our fellow of biblical and systematic theology. He's also pastor of Trinity OPC in Easton, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Lane. It's good to see you calling in from home as well.
Wonderful to be here, Camden. Very excited about this episode.
Yeah, this episode's been some time in coming. We are going to be speaking today about Van Til apologetics. This is, of course, Van Til Group, but it's a unique conversation because we're not opening up Van Til's defense of the faith directly, as we have been in previous episodes. Today, we're going to take a moment and a special opportunity to interact with and assess a new book that's been published by Mentor and written by Keith Matheson. He's written Toward a Reformed Apologetics, which is a critique of the apologetic system and theology of Cornelius Van Til. So we're going to talk today about that, and perhaps not even just today, but we intend to spread this out and have an extended conversation and critique with the arguments presented in the book over perhaps even 3 or 4 episodes. So stay tuned for that. We have lots of material, lots of notes, more than we can address in a normal length podcast. And we're not going to go Rogan or Lex Friedman on you and do a 4-hour episode. We'll still probably try to stick to an hour 10, however we're able. And to get into this, we've got a lot of news. I'm not going to mention anything specific other than our Oklahoma City seminar. We're almost full on that one, but February 21 and 22 in Oklahoma City. Please join us. Lane Tipton and I and Jim Cassidy will be there speaking on a Saturday morning. On Friday night, Marcus Mittinger will join us as well for a live podcast recording. We're going to be talking about redemptive history and the progressive unfolding of Christ throughout Scripture and how we ought to read the Bible redemptive historically and what difference that makes. So we're excited to do that. And the event is free. It's been supported by a generous donor. If you can get there and find a place to stay, preferably you book yourself a room in the hotel, then we'll put you up and we'll have a great reception and a podcast on Friday. We'll provide breakfast on Saturday morning and then have 3 lectures. So we're really looking forward to that. I'll keep it to that. But if you want further updates and news and information, we've got the new publication that's going to be out. We might already have announced it publicly by the time this episode airs, but there's quite a few waiting in the wings. And if you'd like to know about those things right away, visit reformedforum.org or even subscribe to our email newsletter at reformedforum.org/newsletter. Thank you very much. All right, guys, let's get into this book. Let's waste no time. We're going to be opening Toward a Reformed Apologetics by Keith Matheson, published by Mentor. This book's been out for some time, and we've been working through it carefully, patiently. Dr. Matheson's also been speaking about the subject. There's one notable, particularly the one I saw, in a podcast conversation that he had with Kevin DeYoung on Kevin DeYoung's program over at Clearly Reformed. And he spoke with James Anderson, who teaches at RTS. And James, of course, is a pretty well-known Van Tilian. And they had a cordial and charitable, polite conversation about the issues. And I was very thankful for that conversation to expose some of the issues and to talk about the theology and the apologetics therein. We hope also to have a charitable and friendly conversation as well. We're not in conversation directly right now. We're just talking among the three of us. Perhaps that's something we can do down the road, is talk face-to-face or at least virtually as we work through the material. But I don't want to jump right into the critique so much, but I was struck, brothers, in this conversation that a lot of good things were said. I thought there was Dr. Anderson had quite a few excellent and useful explanations of certain features of Vantillian thought. But I was quite struck and really surprised and disappointed that there, as I recall, there was not a single mention of sin or the noetic effects of sin, or particularly the ethical nature of knowledge in that conversation. And even perhaps more surprisingly, I don't recall, and I was paying attention, so maybe I'm wrong. I don't mean to say that I'm infallible here, but I don't recall a single mention of the word covenant or an invocation of the covenant concept in that entire conversation. And we hope to perhaps touch on some of those things and talk about that today, because if we're talking about Van Til's apologetics and theology, it is entirely based and resting upon his understanding of covenant theology and our relationship to God. And we relate to him either through Adam or through Christ, and that means the world. If we don't have those categories in place to begin with, we're never going to understand his formulation of the antithesis. We're not even going to understand how he thinks about and how he presents a doctrine of or thoughts on epistemology, because there's a whole ethical nature to knowledge that is covenantally qualified. And then there are the noetic effects of sin, et cetera. But we'll get to that. We'll have a foretaste of that. But brothers, I'll pass things off to you. Perhaps Carlton, you can talk. You've laid out quite a bit. We have a giant Google document and different buckets in which, as we've been working through the book, we have different thoughts or categories and ways that we've taken some of the material and tried to organize it systematically to a degree so that we might be able to present some of these thoughts in an orderly fashion. So at least in this first installment of our conversation, we can get to that. But even before that, perhaps, Carlton, why don't you share with us maybe, and Lane, what you really appreciate about Dr. Matheson's book?
Yeah. Thanks, Camden. It might be helpful for the listener to know that we are going to try to do multiple episodes on this book. And Lane, I jumped you. Sorry about that. I just wanted to lay out what those episodes might be about, and then we can turn to a positive appreciation. Is that okay?
Oh, wonderful.
Okay.
Free flowing.
Okay. We're thinking, hopefully, you were showing my cards, Camden, with the large Google Doc. We do have about 3 to 4, what I'm calling buckets, big buckets of issues that we want to talk about. And just in very short order, the first bucket, which we're going to try to do in this episode, is the influence of idealism on Van Til. There are other issues related to that, which we'll get into. Second bucket is Matheson's discussion of the antithesis, particularly the distinction that he draws between the antithesis in principle and the antithesis in practice, recognizing the role of common grace. There are lots of issues to discuss there. Third bucket, Van Til on natural theology and the traditional proofs for God's existence, a fan favorite. And then possibly a fourth bucket on things like Van Til's discussion of the Trinity as one person, three persons, his reading of the history of philosophy, his relationship to Old Princeton. So bucket one is Van Til and idealism. But before we even get into that, yeah, let me ask you, Lane, what's positive about Matheson's book? This is a new book published in 2024 by Mentor. Reading it, what did you appreciate?
Well, I appreciated a lot of this. And I want everyone to know who's listening to our program that I spoke to Keith numbers of times over this and consider him a friend and have enjoyed the dialogue with him as he has worked through Van Til's corpus and offered critiques and attempts to help us all understand Van Til better. So I appreciate him as a friend. I appreciate him as a brother in the Lord. First, I think we deeply appreciate Matheson recognizing that Van Til's doctrine of God is not a mutualist view that's found within contemporary evangelicalism. Van Til maintained a robust doctrine of the triune creator as infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being and knowledge in all of his relations. Secondly, I really appreciate and respect the obvious care that Keith took to read Van Til's published writings as broadly as possible. and with a goal to understand his theology and his apologetic on his own term. Critics often simply dismiss Van Til, blatantly misrepresent Van Til with no primary source citations. And Keith really worked hard. Dr. Matheson worked very hard to provide detailed exposition of Van Til as he interacted with him. And third, I think I might appreciate this the most, but I don't want to introduce a hierarchy. I really appreciated Keith's repeated plea that we deal with these issues as brothers in Christ. It's important to remember that many contributors to the literature on Van Til hold to confessional views of God and his revelation, whether Presbyterian or Baptist or otherwise. And we share common doctrinal commitments, but even more basically, we enjoy union and communion with Christ and one another in Christ. And Matheson wants the discussion to reflect that vital doctrinal and spiritual truth. And so I want to reciprocate, especially on that point. I think it's critical to maintain. And I think if we do it and engage the primary sources deeply, we can make great strides forward in understanding Van Til. So I commend Keith, Dr. Matheson, for his emphasis on that point. I think it's only useful for us to keep that, really, that third point I raised, to keep that centered throughout as we assess Van Til and his relation to idealism and other topics.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Lane. That's very well said. I echo everything that you said. I have a long list of things I appreciate in the book as well. I may be overlapping a little bit with what you said, but impressive preparation, a call for improved dialogue, a statement that dialogue over these matters is worth it. We're not wasting our time here. These are important matters. How the Reformed creeds and confessions were Van Til's assumed framework as he sought to develop a truly Reformed apologetic. How he was, speaking of doctrine of God, very strong on the doctrine of immutability. Dr. Matheson recognizes Van Til held that there's an ethical element to all human knowledge. He affirms that Van Til believed that Scripture says something indispensable about all facts. You know, we could start with Genesis 1:1 there. and yes, how he treated even his critics as brothers in Christ in the church. So a lot to appreciate, and I want to join you in offering our criticisms in the spirit of brotherly affection and a desire to read closely and accurately of Van Til and his critics. Well, that being said, I mentioned the 3 to 4 buckets that we're planning on doing. And the first bucket is Van Til and idealism. But let me just prepare the listener that within this bucket, we have 3 mini buckets. we want to talk about basically 3 topics. And the first is this, that as the book advances, this actually doesn't directly relate to idealism yet. It will in a moment. But Dr. Matheson makes the claim that Van Til believed that man must know all about all things in order to know anything about anything. Let me just say that again as clearly as I can, that Dr. Matheson writes that Van Til held that man must know all about all things in order to know anything about anything. Now, just putting it that way sounds stark. Like, how could this possibly be claimed that Van Til believes this? And I want to walk through just a few quotes, if I could, Camden, just where I read Dr. Matheson affirming properly Van Til's understanding of the absoluteness of God and his knowledge. Van Til always began his study of God and man with a firm doctrinal commitment in the absolute triune God who created Adam as his image and related to him in terms of natural and special revelation, so that Adam was called to think God's thoughts after him on a creaturely level. And there are many places in this book where Dr. Matheson recognizes that in Van Til's corpus. For example, page 43. We're going to read some quotes from the book. Dr. Matheson writes, Van Til emphasizes the point that God knows the meaning of every proposition in all the fullness of its significance because he knows it in relationship to all other propositions. We will return to the significance of this doctrine below, but at this point we merely note that according to Van Til, it is in God's omniscience that we discover the solution to the problem of human knowledge. Now, philosophers talk about the problem of human knowledge. I might prefer to rephrase that final line as to say Van Til recognized that God's absoluteness in being and in knowing is the necessary presupposition and backdrop for all finite human knowing. And of course, this does shed light on philosophers' questions about the so-called problem of human knowing. But moving on, let me read another quote from page 63. Matheson writes, man's knowledge of the cow is necessarily finite. And as such, if that knowledge is to be true, it must be grounded in exhaustive knowledge somewhere. God alone has such exhaustive knowledge. So man's knowledge will be true only to the extent that it corresponds to God's perfect knowledge. Again, strong recognition of Van Til's understanding of the creator-creature distinction and relation and the implications of God's omniscience for man's finite and limited knowing. Page 62, again, another good quote. Given that true knowledge of anything requires true knowledge of all things, Van Til teaches that someone must know everything in order for there to be knowledge of anything. Since man is a finite creature and cannot possibly know everything, God's knowledge of everything is necessary in order for there to be true knowledge of anything. Significantly, Van Til adds that human beings themselves do not need to know everything as long as God knows everything. Again, these are strong statements grasping Van Til's understanding of divine omniscience and man's limited knowing. Okay, let me now read a quote from page 48, because things begin to change here. So far, he's been describing Van Til's understanding of revelational epistemology. Page 48, Dr. Matheson writes this. It is also important to note Van Til's claim that the unitary nature of God's plan means that one cannot fully understand any one fact without reference to every other fact. Facts are truly understood or known only when they are known in relation to God and to all other facts in the plan of God. Now, this quote is a little bit different because he starts out by speaking of the unitary nature of God's plan, his all-embracing decree, and he says, facts are truly understood or known only when they are known in relation to God, to which I say, yes and amen, this is Van Til's view, but then Dr. Matheson goes on to say, only when they are known in relation to God and to all other facts in the plan of God. It is left unstated whether it is God who must know all these facts in relation to God and in relation to the entire plan of God, or whether it is man who must know all facts in relation to God and to all other facts in the plan of God. So I just say that's an ambiguous quote. It implies to my eye that he's beginning to talk about man. But then comes a quote on page 122, where he writes this, according to Van Til, in order for there to be true knowledge of any fact, there has to be knowledge of that fact in relation to God, in relation to every other fact that God decreed, and in relation to the whole system of knowledge of which that fact is a part. Again, you could argue, okay, a little ambiguous, not saying who has to have this omniscience. Is it God or is it man? But he goes on the same page, 122. As we have seen, Van Til explicitly repeats this view of knowledge dozens of times throughout his writings. As just one example out of many, he writes, now he's quoting Van Til, we may say that we must know all about all things if we are to know anything about anything. All right, right there, Matheson is claiming that Van Til is asserting that human beings must know all about all things if we are to know anything about anything, that man must be omniscient if he is to assert anything true about anything in God's world. Okay, is Van Til really saying this? Well, the quote on page 122 is from a Banner article from 1931. It's an article titled A Christian Theistic Theory of Knowledge. And this quote is from a long section where Van Til is walking through knowledge of a cow. But critically, as Van Til explores what is implied in true knowledge of a cow, the context of the quote shows that Van Til is assuming the voice of an unbeliever. Let me read a broader context from this Banner article. Van Til begins, and this is going to be a little bit on the longer side, so forgive me. Van Til says this: suppose then that there is a God. He will have the best outside view of us. Our idea of ourselves would be wholly wrong unless it corresponded to God's outside knowledge of us. Thus, we begin to see that if we are to have an answer to the question of what a cow is, we must first know all about God and man. In other words, we may say that we must know all about all things if we are to know anything about anything. Okay, that's the quote that Matheson lifts and says this is Van Til's view of human knowledge. Van Til, however, in the original quote, goes on, we must answer then that we do not know what a cow is. But such an admission does not seem to be so serious. Even if I don't know what a cow is, I can milk it anyway. But the question becomes more serious when I'm asked whether I know myself. I must know a good deal about myself. There are those who claim to have an outside view of me, and they say that I'm a sinner and damnation bound. Is that true? I ask them how they know. They tell me that the revelation of God tells them about it. Is there such a revelation? Perhaps there is not. But am I sure that there is not? Okay, already you can see that he's speaking like an unbeliever, unfolding the problem of how he knows what a cow is. And he's hypothetically engaging with Christians who are telling him that there's revelation from God that tells him he's a sinner. Van Til goes on, I grow desperate. I must know here and now whether I know. In despair, I look again at that revelation of which my accusers speak. The scriptures tell me that God knows all about all things. Suppose that this claim is true. Would that help me? Would that make me know all things? No. It would not make me know all things, but it would help me just the same. A child does not need to know all about the road he is to travel, if only his father does. So the broader context of this Banner article is clearly showing that Van Til is assuming the voice of an unbeliever and is most certainly not arguing that finite human beings need to be omniscient if they are to know anything about anything. We simply need to submit to the revelation of God and understand that, yes, all things are related to God, but that the God who has all knowledge has revealed a sufficient portion of his knowledge to us as finite creatures so that we can confidently affirm true things about him, about the world, and about ourselves. So I want to pause right there and just leave it open to you guys. Do you have anything to add about that? Am I reading Matheson correctly, that he acknowledges the role of God and then God sort of fades into the background as omniscience is asserted as a criteria for human knowing?
I think you got it exactly right. I think you misunderstood in that particular moment. The earlier quotes, he seems to be understanding the mechanism and of the basic principles of revelational epistemology, but in that quote, Van Til is espousing the unbelieving view in order to instruct us. And he lifts the portion of that dialogue of Van Til speaking as an unbeliever and being challenged with the Christian view and wrestling with it to then impute to Van Til the very things Van Til was denying. in that quotation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Lane.
Yeah. What's if you could revisit that quotation which you've given us, and Van Til's point is even stronger than this. You could put it this way: does Van Til believe that man can know everything? No. Does he believe that man can know everything even given revelation? No. Therefore, there's no plausible contextual reason why we should say that Matheson has understood Van Til properly on this point. It's assuming the prerogative and the voice of the unbeliever, and it's not Van Til's own positive, constructive, epistemological axiom. So, yeah, I think you're right on the money. I agree with Camden as well.
Okay, this quote, and I don't want to just harp on one quote, but it's the clearest assertion of the requirement of human omniscience for knowing anything truly about anything. Again, the quote reads, "We may say that we must know all about all things if we were to know anything about anything." And we've seen the broader context in which that quotation appears. Now, Dr. Matheson repeats this line later, not just on page 122, but it reappears on page 158 and 159. Let me read that portion, which gets into a little more of idealist influence charges, which we're going to get to in due time. But we just want to stick on this kind of more simpler assertion for the moment. Matheson writes this on page 158, 159. "Having traced Van Til's theory of knowledge throughout his system of thought, it is abundantly evident that there is propositional influence of idealism here." Now, let me pause. We're going to talk about propositional influence of idealism, what he means by that. But he goes that there is propositional influence of idealism here. Van Til has replanted this specific element of idealist epistemology into Reformed soil. As we've seen, he explicitly repeats this idealist understanding of knowledge dozens of times, and he assumes it throughout his writings. As just one example of many, he writes, "We may say that we must know all about all things if we are to know anything about anything." Okay, this is the exact same quotation used on page 122, drawn from that 1931 Banner article. Matheson goes on to say, "This is true," he says, "because," quote, "all knowledge is interrelated." That's a quote from Van Til as well. As Van Til explains, here comes another Van Til quote, "The mind of man is a unit. It cannot know one thing truly without knowing all things truly." Matheson concludes, these are merely a handful of the many instances where this idealist view of knowledge is expressed or implied by Van Til. Okay, he has repeated the same quotation from 122 on page 158, 159, and he's added two more. Let me just walk through these three quotes by Van Til in this quotation. The first we've already addressed. "We must know all about all things if we're to know anything about anything." This is Van Til speaking as an unbeliever, working out the implications of what it means to know what a cow is. The second quotation is, "All knowledge is interrelated." Matheson has said, "This is true because," Van Til quotation, "all knowledge is interrelated." Now, this quotation by Van Til is from chapter 3 of his Introduction to Systematic Theology. The context of this quotation is Van Til discussing the unbeliever's ethical rebellion against God due to sin, and that the implications for man's fallenness and depravity, for his interpretation of everything in the world that God has made. Let me read the broader context from the IST. Van Til writes, "We are well aware of the fact that non-Christians have a great deal of knowledge about this world, which is true as far as it goes. That is, there is a sense in which we can and must allow for the value of knowledge of non-Christians." Now, we're going to deal with that in bucket 2 in a later episode. What is the nature of non-Christian knowing? How does common grace relate? and so on. But Van Til goes on in this quote, IST, he says this, "However, we must begin by emphasizing the absolute ethical antithesis in which the natural man stands to God. This implies that he knows nothing truly as he ought to know it. It means, therefore, that the natural man is not only basically mistaken in his notions about religion and God, but is as basically mistaken in his notions about the atoms and laws of gravitation. From this ultimate point of view, the natural man knows nothing truly. He has chains about his neck and sees shadows only. It is this point on which many theologians are vague. They maintain, to be sure, that the natural man cannot truly know God, but they will not maintain that the natural man cannot truly know the flowers of the field. Now, it may seem as though it is straining at a gnat to insist on the point that the natural man does not even know the flowers truly, as long as it's maintained that he does not know God truly. The point is, however, that unless we maintain that the natural man does not know the flowers truly, we cannot logically maintain that he does not know God truly." Now, here comes the quote Matheson used. "All knowledge is interrelated. The created world is expressive of the nature of God. If one knows nature truly, one knows nature's God truly. Then, too, the mind of man is a unit. It cannot know one thing truly without knowing all things truly." Now, that final line is the third quotation that Dr. Matheson cited in his section on page 158, 159. "All knowledge is interrelated, and the mind of man is a unit. It cannot know one thing truly without knowing all things truly." Here again, Van Til is not asserting that man must be omniscient in order to know all things truly, anything truly. What he is saying is that the knowledge of anything, whether it's flowers of the field or the being of God, all of it must be and is related to God. That he is the center foundational reference point for knowing anything truly. Van Til in no sense means that a finite human being must be omniscient in order to know everything. What he is saying is that total depravity affects a person's view of everything in the world, whether it's himself or finite objects of his observation or abstract concepts or mathematics or art or beauty or whatever, or anything he says about God. Sin, it corrupts it and infects it all. He does not mean that man must be omniscient. So again, to say that Van Til is arguing that because of idealist influence, which we're going to get to, that man must know everything, that Van Til believed that, in my opinion, is to misread Van Til's statements in their context.
I think it goes further than that, too. I mean, it's very important that you so rightly explain that the context of this is on the ethical nature of knowledge, too. And I think a lot of people that critique Van Til, they miss this point, especially when Van Til uses the word true and truly. There's a way to understand that strictly epistemologically and ostensibly secularly, which is not possible. But some people might think, well, truly just means, is it correct? Is it accurate? Is my knowledge corresponding to reality? Van Til has other things in mind. It's not less than that, but it's more than that. Because for people who might be wondering what's going on here, just for the moment, whenever you see true or truly in this section, replace it with righteously or faithfully and think of that. Because if you're reading and you say, as Van Til explains, the mind of man is a unit. It cannot know one thing faithfully or righteously without knowing all things faithfully or righteously, etc. Van Til's talking about the unbeliever being in rebellion against God. And we need to have a right relationship to God by covenant through Christ in order for any of our knowledge to please the Lord. Like even when the unbeliever knows 2 + 2 = 4, that's tainted with sin. And that is, he's on the wrong side of an ethical, absolute ethical antithesis. And even his knowledge, which ostensibly is accurate and corresponds to reality, is still wrong. That's the point that I think that Van Til is making in this section.
That's so helpful, Camden. We're going to get to that more when we talk about common grace and how the epistemological rebellion of the unbeliever still remains in his heart, even where common grace permits him and enables him to formally affirm true things about the world. That's a very critical point that right. I think is also missed a bit in this
Absolutely.
Book. But just to go back to page 108, where he's describing Van Til's epistemology, Dr. Matheson makes the point that you made about what truly means for Van mm-hmm. Til. He says, for example, he quotes Van Til from Survey of Christian Epistemology, "I know a fact truly to the extent that I understand the exact relations of such a fact sustains to the plan of God. As a result," Van Til goes on, "the only possible way for the Christian to reason with the unbeliever is the way by way of presupposition. He must say to the unbeliever that unless he will accept the presupposition and with him the interpretation of Christianity, there is no coherence in human experience. In other words," Matheson says, "the Christian reasons with the unbeliever by telling him that he must acknowledge God as the final reference point of all interpretation if he is to have true knowledge of anything." It seems right there that Dr. Matheson does acknowledge that truly, to know something truly for Van Til means to acknowledge it as a created fact of God existing for his glory, that springs from a heart that's been reconciled to God in Christ. Not to deny the presence of ongoing indwelling sin, but it is to say that there is no pristine, sinless recognition of any created fact by the unbeliever that is disjointed or hermetically sealed from his rebellion against God. Lane, what do you have to add on this point?
Well, I'll give two amens to both of you. I think you've done a fantastic job. One slightly different but complementary way to put this is that when Van Til's talking about the interrelated character of knowledge, he's wanting to say that total depravity affects a person's view of everything in terms of every faculty. The mind is darkened. The will is enslaved. The affections are misdirected. So that if a person is in fallen Adam and not in Christ, there is a totalizing and comprehensive depravity that exerts itself in every interpretation of every fact. In antithesis to that, if a person has been reconciled to God in Christ, is regenerated by the Spirit of Christ, what happens? The mind is renewed, the will is freed, the affections are inflamed to the things of God, and that bears on the interpretation of every fact in the world. Van Til's making a statement about the comprehensive character of sin on the one side for all of Adam's descendants who have lost original righteousness or guilty of original sin, are corrupt in every aspect of their being on the one side, and those who in union with Christ have been renewed in true knowledge, righteousness, and holiness, every faculty now reordered to glorify God. And that so that integration he's speaking of, as you brothers are rightly pointing out, is ethical and even more basically covenantal in character. It's a comprehensive, integrated, God-centered Christian worldview that Van Til's talking about. And I think that when you view it that way, the points that we're making here reveal Van Til is just a Reformed theologian, someone seeking to be a consistent Reformed theologian on these matters.
And that's what we don't want to jump ahead, but is what he's talking about with regard to there's no neutrality. Every human is either in Adam or in Christ. And we'll talk in future episodes more about common grace, and there's a point of contact in the image of God. There's all of these things to discuss. So we can have genuine conversations. Unbelievers do know things. They have knowledge. They operate in the world most of the time, and in certain respects, they often know way more than believers do. Nevertheless, there's this ethical antithesis, which is a direct consequence and function of covenant theology. And there is no third group. There's either those fallen in Adam, which is all of humanity, and those who've been redeemed from that state of sin and misery by Christ. You're either in Adam or you're in Christ, and you can't be in both.
Yeah, just as a little preview for bucket two, which is the antithesis in principle versus in practice, what I believe Dr. Matheson is going to assert on that topic is that everything that we've said is true in principle. How total depravity affects everything so that no unbeliever knows anything truly, defined as we've defined it. However, Dr. Matheson is going to argue, Van Til's doctrine of common grace pulls the rug out from all of this by essentially negating the antithesis when it comes to non-Christian knowledge. Now, we don't have time to dive into that one, but let me just dip a toe into bucket three regarding natural theology and the traditional proofs, because this issue of whether man must be omniscient in order to say anything true about anything reappears in one quotation about traditional proofs, and I think you'll hear it when I read this very short quotation, and then we can move on. This quotation comes on page 160. Dr. Matheson's describing Van Til's posture toward traditional proofs, and he puts it this way. Because traditional apologetic methods assume that fallen man can have true knowledge of some facts without having knowledge of all facts, traditional apologetics must be rejected. Now, that's his characterization of Van Til's view, but notice the way that he put it. Because traditional apologetic methods assume that fallen man can have true knowledge of some facts without having knowledge of all facts, the implication of that quotation is that Van Til believes that man must have knowledge of all facts, or he cannot have any knowledge of some facts. And because traditional apologetics cuts against this alleged position by Van Til, that that's one of the reasons that Van Til rejects traditional proofs. Now, so this issue of the requirement of human omniscience weaves its way into other things that Dr. Matheson wants to critique Van Til about, which we'll have to get to in due time. Go ahead.
I've got something I'd like to throw in here that I think is important. I want to read a couple of quotations, and I think we need to recognize something in addition to what we've said. Everything we've said up to this point, I think, is sufficient to determine that Matheson's reading here is not right. It's flawed. But let me say something. When Van Til says that man must know all things in order to know anything, he's not presenting his own idealist view of knowledge. We've established that. Rather, he is critiquing and rejecting the false ideal of knowledge that Adam assumed in the fall in his original sin against God, and which, as we extend it, Van Til's going to see at the center of idealist theories of knowledge. Let me give you two quotes from Defense of the Faith 311. This is the original first edition. The non-Christian also interprets the facts in terms of his presuppositions. On his principles, he knows everything, if he knows anything. Well, do explain, Dr. Van Til. Okay, Christian Apologetics, pages 10 and 11. The basic principle of the non-Christian conception of truth cannot be challenged. According to this most basic assumption, it is man rather than God that is the final reference point in all predication. A moment's reflection upon the fall of man in paradise will prove this to be true. In paradise, God said to man that if he ate of the forbidden fruit, he would surely die. The truth about the facts in the created universe, Adam and Eve were told in effect, could be known ultimately only if one knew their relationship to the plan of God. It is this plan of God that makes all created facts to be what they are. Satan, however, suggested to Eve that God's statement about the relation of one temporal fact to another was not determinative of the nature of that relationship. Facts and their truth about their relationships to one another can be known only by man. Satan contended in effect, without getting any information about them from God as their maker and controller. How can this be true? Here it is. In rejecting God's interpretation of the future relationship of temporal facts to one another, man could only rest upon the powers of logical thought within himself. He had to assume that these powers could somehow legislate for what is to be in the future. He had, in short, to assume that his powers of logic could legislate for what is possible and impossible in reality around about him. He had to say, in effect, that what God had said would not come, could not possibly come about, and he had to find the power of legislation exclusively with himself. Van Til goes on in Survey and in Christian Theory of Knowledge to call that a, quote, false ideal of knowledge, that Adam had to presume, in principle, his own omniscience in order to challenge the interpretation that if I eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I will not die, I will, in fact, live, Satan's hypothesis. And so I think it's very important to recognize that when Van Til is speaking about, and this, Carlton, this comes back to that very first quote you read from the survey. When Van Til's speaking about this knowing all things in order to know anything, what he's ultimately talking about is the presupposition of fallen Adam in the Garden of Eden, the false ideal of knowledge that he had to assume in order to justify eating from the forbidden fruit. So far from being a positive proposition, Van Til's actually stating, critiquing, and rejecting what he saw originating in Adam's fall.
That's so helpful, Lane. I mean, I want the listener to understand this, that what you're saying here, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but so correct me if I'm wrong, what you're saying is that what Dr. Matheson ascribes to Van Til, namely human omniscience, in order to say anything true about any created fact, is actually the false ideal that Van Til recognizes Satan proposed to Adam in the Garden of Eden.
It's the ultimate category confusion in his reading of Van Til on this point.
Yeah. The reason being is because the unbeliever doesn't acknowledge God as the ultimate epistemic foundation, and they have themselves at the center of their own professed universe, and therefore they assume this idolatrous position of being their own epistemological foundation. Therefore, the burden is upon them to know all things if they're going to be this foundation.
Yes.
But that's exactly what Van Til is saying is wrong, and that's what's so heinous and idolatrous and blasphemous about the unbeliever's position.
Camden, if we were to look down the river just a little farther in terms of how this relates to apologetics, Van Til is going to say that the very false ideal that is his burden, as you put it, is the very thing that a finite image bearer can never achieve. And Van Til is going to say that is the foundation for the internal problems and contradictions of every unbelieving worldview,
right,
is that presuming to be God,
right,
they cannot attain godlike status.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Van Til is going to leverage in order to present a devastating critique of all forms of unbelieving thought in one way or another. So this is a very important point, not just to get Christian epistemology right, of course, not just to get Van Til right, but Christian epistemology and a Reformed apologetic approach that's, I think, faithful to Scripture.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Okay,
we'll talk more about that. I'm looking forward to it. All the borrowed capital, talking about the internal critique. The unbeliever has to steal all sorts of things from the Christian view of the world. I know we'll talk about worldview as well, because that's come under fire. But the Christian, the non-Christian, has to steal all these building supplies in order to try to make sense out of their own. And then we as apologists stand on their foundation, their supposed foundation, temporarily, for the sake of the argument, and just point out all the stuff they stole from the Lord and all the ways in which, without those things, their whole life is built on sand and it collapses. And then we offer the hope of the gospel as the true and solid foundation, the rock upon which we stand. That's the whole thing in a nutshell.
Right. Right. Well, I think the average listener, when I like came out of the gate and said, okay, Dr. Matheson holds that gradually it emerges. It doesn't start this way, but it comes to be clear that he charges Van Til with believing that man must be omniscient. Like, I think the question rises, where did this allegedly come from? Like, what is Dr. Matheson saying influenced Van Til to come to this conclusion that man must be omniscient in order to know anything at all? And I think if you brothers think it's time, maybe it's helpful to move toward the second little bucket in bucket one, which is his description of the so-called propositional influence of idealism on Van Til. Now, a listener needs to be aware that this is probably the more challenging point of the three we're going to make. But Lane, can we first talk about I actually think this is helpful in some respects. What is propositional influence as opposed to other kinds of influence? You know, people say, oh, Van Til was influenced by idealism. And I actually think Dr. Matheson does a good job of saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. There are different kinds of influence, right? Right. You know, when you and I taught a class on Karl Barth, we were influenced by Barth in as much as we prepared lectures on Barth, you know what I mean, in order to critique him. So what are the different kinds? I'll try to find it in my copy, but what are the different kinds of influence that Dr. Matheson identifies? Yeah. And then what is propositional influence?
Yeah, let me define this. I think we're getting kind of now into one of the deeper structures in his critique of Van Til, because this explains why Matheson thinks Van Til holds the positive teaching that man must know everything about everything in order to know anything about anything. It's due to the propositional influence of British absolute idealism on Van Til. Now, that notion, propositional influence, is the key concept in Matheson's argument that idealism corrupted Van Til's epistemology, apologetic, and theology. And it, in distinction from propositional influence, before I define it, let me read from page 151, where Matheson maps out other kinds of proposition, other kinds of influence on Van Til that he says is probably not either present in Van Til or wouldn't be dangerous. Here he says first, Matheson posits, quote, lexical influence. This is a quote from page 151. Lexical influence, in this case, a theologian simply borrows philosophical terms and gives those terms Christian definitions. Secondly, strategic influence. In this case, the major question asked and the major problems raised by a particular philosophical school set the agenda in some way for theologians' methodology. Fourth, and we'll come to the third in a second, systematic or systemic influence. In this case, a philosophical system as a whole is adopted and then functions as a foundation for a theological system. This would involve a complete synthesis of Christian theology with that philosophical system. End of quote. Now, let me say this before we talk about what propositional influence is. Matheson's saying none of these forms of influence capture the problem with Van Til's embrace of idealism. He recognizes Van Til took the term concrete universal, which refers to the synthesis of the eternal and the temporal in a process through time. Van Til took that term, concrete universal, and said, nope, that refers to the eternally self-complete ontological trinity. And he did it in order to speak to idealists. And he did it in order to say no to their rank idolatrous correlativism. That's not a problem. That's fine. That's very similar to John in John 1 taking the Logos from the Stoics and filling it with the content of Orthodox Trinitarianism. The other two influences, Matheson is very quick to concede, don't plague Van Til. Van Til did not let philosophical schools affect his overarching methodology, his method as a whole, nor did he engage in a complete synthesis with philosophical views. So those are not the areas where Matheson is going to claim the problem lies when it comes to the influence of idealism on Van Til, absolute idealism. But he says there is a fourth category called propositional influence, and that is the problem point. Here's how he defines it. This is also on page 151. A propositional influence occurs, quote, when a theologian borrows what he believes to be individual true teachings from a philosophical system and incorporates them into his philosophical or theological system. Theological system, page 151. So propositional influence is this. It's not taking the system as a whole. It's instead taking an individual, isolated, atomic truth or principle, taking it out of the philosophical system and placing it or replanting it into Christian theology. Page 158. After quoting David Boucher and Andrew Vincent on British idealism, he says that what this ultimately means is that reality is a unity of a type, something like that postulated by the coherence theory, and we're near to Bradley's conclusion that we could know one thing fully without knowing everything else also. He says, having traced Van Til's theory of knowledge throughout his system of thought, it's abundantly evident that there has been, now here's the key quote, a propositional influence of idealism here. Van Til has replanted this specific element of idealist epistemology into Reformed soil. Okay, now we're back to where Carleton began. We cannot know one thing fully without knowing everything also. In other words, to know one thing truly, we have to know all things exhaustively, F.H. Bradley's view. That is the propositional influence. That's what Van Til takes, pulls it out of idealism, and now replants that specific element of idealist epistemology into Reformed soil. So now we get to see that the propositional influence rests precisely on that first point that we raised. Now, where did he get that? Where did Matheson get that? Well, Matheson on pages 152 and 153 quotes Scott Oliphant's article from the Westminster Theological Journal in 1990, making this very point, this point that Matheson is making. Quote, I'll read Matheson, who's quoting Oliphant, and I'll tell you where the Oliphant quote begins. Matheson, quote, some prominent Van Tilian scholars have claimed that there is evidence of such influence, namely propositional influence as we've just defined it. Oliphant, for example, says, quote, Van Til took that which was formerly true in idealism, due to common grace, and transplanted it into the Reformed Christian faith, and there he nurtured and watered it to fruition, because only in Christian soil could these formerly true ideas have their proper growing place. When he uses arguments, terms, and methods of idealism, therefore, we must see them as surgically removed and then transplanted into the light of scriptural truth. Now, one more longer quotation that will help you see what, actually, Carlton, I believe this is the one that you have read earlier. He says this. This is Matheson summarizing propositional influence. Having traced Van Til's theory of knowledge throughout his system of thought, it is abundantly evident that there is a propositional influence of idealism here. Van Til has replanted this specific element of idealist epistemology into Reformed soil. As we have seen, he explicitly repeats this idealist understanding of knowledge dozens of times, and he assumes it throughout his writings. As just one example out of many, he writes, "We may say that we must know about all things if we're to know anything about anything. This is true," he says, "because all knowledge is interrelated." As Van Til explains, the mind of man is a unit. It cannot know one thing truly without knowing all things truly. These are merely a handful of the many instances where the idealist view of knowledge is expressed or implied by Van Til. Of course, when Van Til replants this idealist understanding of true knowledge into Reformed soil, it is now the unified mind and plan of God within which all facts are said to be related. God's eternal plan now provides the ultimate unified context for all facts. Each fact can be truly known only in relation to the other facts in that plan and in relation to the God who decreed it. Van Til argues that according to the Christian view, nothing can be known truly of any fact unless it be known through and by way of man's knowledge of God.
Okay, brother, am I cutting you off? You want to say something?
No.
Okay. I struggle with that quote because he goes on to say, as you just read, of course, when Van Til replants this idealist understanding of true knowledge into Reformed soil, it's now the unified mind and plan of God within which all facts are said to be related. And yet, his definition of propositional influence, as you read from page 121, is when a theologian borrows what he believes to be individual true teachings from his philosophical system and incorporates them into his theological system. You guys have heard me use this illustration before of playing Jenga, you know, the wooden tower with the blocks. Yes. And when I read propositional influence, I was like, oh boy, this is Jenga theology coming here, where you just tap out a little wooden brick, unmodified, you take that brick and you slide it into your second Jenga tower, which is Christian theology. And he is arguing that this is the kind of influence that idealism has had on Van Til. Where did we get the idea that man must know everything in order to know anything about anything? He says it's from idealism. And yet in this quote, he says, of course, when he replants this idealist understanding of true knowledge into Reformed soil, it's now the unified mind and plan of God within which all facts are said to be related. Now, we have more to say about the way in which idealism proper envisioned the absolute and the interrelationship of all facts that makes it fundamentally different from God's sovereign decree. But I just see Dr. Matheson hovering between unrefined appropriation of a allegedly true insight of idealism, while at times acknowledging, okay, Van Til is actually doing something a little bit different.
Yes.
Is that fair? That's what kind of frustrated me a little bit reading about Van Til's alleged use of idealist thought.
Yes. And if you leave it, here's the key. As we're starting to, now we're going to get even more specific here. If you leave it at that level, it's still fuzzy. What are you saying, Dr. Matheson? Why is there this lack of clarity? But I'm just going to give you two terms that he uses repeatedly. Pages 154 and 157, they feature prominently. He explains much more precisely where that borrowed influence, that surgical removal, where that propositional influence emerges. He has two specific phrases that he uses that are technical terms within the literature, and it really helps us understand more concretely what Matheson claims. And this is it. Van Til, according to Matheson, extracted without changing the specific element of internal relations, quote unquote, and epistemological holism from British absolute idealism, and replanted it as such into the soil of Reformed theology. So Matheson is explicit. And I'm quoting him here. I'll give you where the quotes are. Van Til extracted without change, quote, the specific element, quote unquote, of internal relations, quote unquote, and epistemological holism from British absolute idealism, and replanted that as such into the soil of Reformed theology. So the question becomes, is that possible? Is it possible to extract without change, Jenga-like, Carlton? Let's use it this illustration. Can we Jenga pull the internal relations doctrine? Can we Jenga pull epistemological holism from the British absolute idealists like Bradley and replant it into Christian soil? Is that even possible? Well, that depends. If the answer to that question quite obviously depends on what an internal relation is and what epistemological holism is. And so let me put it let me begin by putting it this way. And if you brothers want to weigh in, if you want to jump in, please do. But in British absolute idealism, the doctrine of internal relations and epistemological holism cannot be taken as a true proposition in a wholesale manner and replanted in a direct and atomistic way into the soil of Reformed theology. It's not possible once you understand what an internal relation is and what epistemological holism is in British absolute idealism. So let me begin here by defining an internal relation and how it relates to epistemological holism within the development of the absolute. And I'm going to start with a quote from F.H. Bradley and then clarify. Bradley, in Appearance and Reality, page 466, says this: "Everything, quote, everything, myself included, is essential to and is inseparable from the absolute." End of quote. Let me explain. Everything that exists is essential to and inseparable from the relata, the entities related within the absolute. Now, you say that sounds abstract. Well, bear with me. What does that mean? That means that the nature and identity of the absolute is constituted and develops along with all of the entities related to it. If you're starting to hear Hegel, Hegel's in the background of British absolute idealism. So what is an internal relation? An internal relation refers to a relationship that is essential to and inseparable from the things related, so that the things related would not be what they are without that relationship. Epistemological holism refers to all of the interconnected relations that corporately form the absolute. So given the doctrine of internal relations, the absolute, which is just reality as a whole, the absolute contains within itself all finite subjects and objects that stand in a mutually determining and an interdependent series of relations. That's what epistemological holism is. Bradley says again, and this is from his Principles. He says, quote, "This is the doctrine for which I have now for so many years contended. Relations exist only in and through a whole which cannot in the end be resolved into relations and terms, and together and between are all in the end senseless apart from the whole or a whole. The opposite view is maintained, as I understand it, by Mr. Russell, but for myself, I am unable to find Mr. Russell has ever really faced the question." Now, pause for a second and think about that quote. What is the whole for Bradley? The whole simply is the absolute in all of its internal relations. Note well, he says, from such a whole, because the conception of the whole, the precise conception of the whole, not just the whole, but the whole as it is developing and being determined by all these internal relations, that's the all-important point. So once we define internal relations within the absolute this way, there's no possible way that we can discern a propositional influence on Van Til. Why? Because the idealist notion of an internal relation and epistemological holism means that the whole of reality is an interdependent whole where each entity related determines the relation, the nature of all other entities. What does that mean? Let me put it this way. There cannot be, for Bradley, given internal relations, given epistemological holism, and given the absolute, there cannot be an independent, immutable, omniscient being. He can't exist. So to extract internal relation, to extract epistemological holism, to abstract the absolute system, is to abstract that which by its very nature, on its own terms, would destroy Christian theism's foundation, an independent, immutable, omniscient God. And
I agree with you entirely there, but it also, wouldn't it just be, isn't this all backwards? Because the whole principle is that the unbeliever is stolen from the Christian system to make sense of his own. So this transplanting is kind of pointless and nonsense. Because it's just identifying that there might be certain formal features of an unbelieving system that formally, now I'm not talking in terms of substance and the way they function, but is all knowledge connected? Yeah, that's actually a Christian idea. And we see that in idealism. So it's not Van Til pulling the Jenga block out. It's more or less trying to be able to communicate and speak into a world that's a philosophical world that's, at the time, quite, dominated by idealists. How do you speak to them? Well, you speak to them using the terms, but these terms have not originated with the idealists, properly speaking. They're native and essential to what has been revealed in Scripture and in nature.
That's exactly right. And if you understand the nature of an internal relation as the entities involved determine one another, change with one another. And you try to take that Jenga block out. Well, look at what you're taking out.
Yeah, that's just
you
false.
Are taking out the biggest correlativist block in the system,
right?
And saying this block unchanged, I'm now going to put in Christian soil. Well, what would happen if you put it in true Christian thought? It would explode. Right. It can't be integrated. Yeah,
that's not even formally correct, is that?
Exactly. And so as much as I appreciate Matheson trying to define a sense in which Van Til might take Jenga style, an isolated truth on its own terms, and put it into Christian soil, here's the point. Internal relations and epistemological holism, which assume this dynamic, evolving, correlativist, mutualist absolute, are certainly not the things that can be taken and replanted, because they are absolutely antithetical to and destructive of the God that we hold dear.
Lane, I'm sorry to jump in.
Yes. Fine.
When you said he claims without change, I was like, that was like a gut punch. And I was like, well, okay, where does he say that? And I'm searching our document, but I'm realizing that it's actually embedded in his definition of propositional influence.
Yes.
The theologian borrows what he believes to be individual true teachings.
That's it.
From a philosophical system and incorporates them. That's the Jenga style stuff. And you're saying that if there's propositional influence of epistemological holism and internal relations from the philosophy of idealism, Christianity is where those things go to die.
That's not exactly right.
Yeah.
And in fact, Carlton, what I'm trying to say is that that Van Til precisely denied that the doctrine of internal relations, the doctrine of epistemological holism, and the doctrine of the absolute, he denied their individual true teachings.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And therefore, they are precisely what he rejected most strenuously. Let me give you just a few quotes. May I give just a few quotes of Van Til speaking about Bradley in particular? Because Bradley is the person that Matheson cites in a number of places to locate this influence, this propositional influence from internal relations and epistemological holism. Listen to what Van Til said about Bradley and British idealism. He said, quote, this is from Christianity and Idealism, page 16. The difference in metaphysics corresponds to the difference in epistemology. From the idealistic assumption that all thought is of one type, it follows that the universe is a wider concept than God. It is the universe, in the case of Bradley, as in the case of other idealists, that is really the absolute. God and man operate within the universe. They are aspects of this universe, correlatives of one another. They are really equally ultimate aspects, or they could not be aspects of one reality at all. Van Til continues. 16-17. In the first place, in Bradley's metaphysics, man is a charter member of the universe. This implies not only that plurality is for Bradley as basic as unity, to which, if applied to the Trinity, the theist will agree, but that the conditions to which man is subject will influence reality as a whole. Reality becomes the one subject to which all predicates must apply in the same way. Secondly, a corollary derived from the first point is that time must be real for God in the same sense that it is real for man. There's internal relations. There's epistemological holism. There's the nature of the absolute for Bradley. Continue, quote, if time is unreal for God, it must be proved that the absolute or universe as a whole is as non or supratemporal. On the other hand, if it should be possible to prove the unreality of time for man, it will be equally impossible to maintain the supratemporal nature of God. Finally, in their magnificent works on logic, both Bradley and Bosanquet have developed a theory of judgment in which the human individual making the judgment is but the mouthpiece of the absolute speaking about itself. End of quote.
Lane, this is all one circle thinking. This is all God, the so-called absolute, and creation developing in a mutual plane of development. This is correlativism with a capital C. This is the heartbeat of everything that Van Til rejected in his affirmation of the creator-creature distinction and the absolute unchanging God who genuinely relates to a changing creation. And I hope it's okay to say this. Matheson commendably acknowledges Van Til's insistence on divine immutability. Mm-hmm. And Matheson commendably asserts that that students of Van Til, and I'm bringing up their names because Matheson does, namely Dr. Frame and Dr. Oliphant, have posited, in the case of Frame, a second mode of being with God that changes with creation, And Dr. Oliphant has posited created attributes that God assumes to himself in order to relate to a changing creation. And he says on page 215, I did not find anything in Van Til that would directly link him to such doctrines. In fact, he himself would have considered any denial of immutability to be an example of what he called correlativism. And there is no question that he would have harshly condemned any proponent of such teachings. This is because he directly connects divine immutability to divine independence or aseity. The issue I have, though, is that after making this strong affirmation of what Van Til himself would think of students of his who introduce correlativity at one place or another, he turns around and argues that Van Til embraces that very kind of correlativity through the influence of idealism, the propositional influence of idealism. So on the one side, Matheson recognizes what Van Til would reject. And yet on the other side, I think he erroneously asserts that Van Til embraced something that he strenuously rejected.
That's true. And you know, the irony on this, Carlton, on this particular narrow point, is that he is very clear that you cannot follow the teaching of Frame, two modes of existence, Oliphant, covenantal, mutable, assumed properties, because those are dipolar constructions, right? Those are two attributes, two contrasting sets of attributes that you're ascribing to God. And so you can't follow Frame, you can't follow Oliphant in their understanding of theology proper. They would be bad guides if they said Van Til teaches this, as Oliphant has said. But what's so ironic is that I think one of, I don't want to overstate this, but perhaps the main reason why Matheson believes there's a propositional influence of idealism on Van Til is because he's following Oliphant's interpretation from his 1990 Consistency of Van Til article, which we quoted earlier. Yeah. And so it's very strange to me that he would recognize you can't follow what Oliphant's saying about God because it's contradicting what Van Til says. Oliphant holds to a correlativist or mutualist doctrine of God, yet he follows Oliphant's interpretation of the influence of idealism on Van Til, which would mean, if it were true, that Van Til would be a correlativist or a mutualist than whom few greater could be conceived, because he would have excised the true elements of internal relations, epistemological holism, and he would have surrendered an immutable, self-contained, omniscient God, a God whose nature is not determined by his relation to creatures, is not changed by his relation to creatures. In fact, that's why Van Til, as we said, would deny the very possibility of propositional influence on those two areas where Matheson said it was exerted against him, because it would destroy the creator-creature relation in the very adoption and appropriation of those propositions.
Well, okay, let's, the listener is being very patient with us as we dive into the intricacies of idealism. Yeah. So let's pierce through the complexity to the simplicity on the other side and move to the third mini bucket, if you will. Let's assume that Van Til, that Matheson would agree that Van Til rejects just crass correlativism, as we know that Matheson affirms that Van Til rejects it. But let's just say, okay, the influence of idealism is not as wholesale. It's not as individual true teachings. Even that might be too strong. But what Van Til maintains is a coherentist epistemology. He rejects a developing absolute. Of course, he develops that God changes with the world, or that we're all sort of part of one big happy metaphysical family. But he maintains a coherentist epistemology. Lane, describe what is that? If you reject the developmental absolute, and what does Van Til say about a coherence theory of truth?
Okay, let's put it this way. Let's assume, like you said, that Matheson and others want to back off the idea that he excised internal relations and epistemological holism, because that entails this whole developing, evolving absolute where the identity and nature of the absolute is being determined by the internal relations within it. Okay, that's sure. Common. No good. Let's just say that what Van Til actually believed, and I think Matheson hints at this and makes a pretty clear case about this on pages 158 and 153, that Van Til held to a coherence theory of truth. And think of it this way. Let's think of things not as dynamic but static, not as developmental but timeless, and that there's this grand system of inferentially related truths. Kind of think Gordon Clark, if you want to just do this, that there is a system of inferential relations that are out there, and that that system of inferential relations and all of their hierarchically ordered relations gives coherence to our thinking. And so a coherence theory of truth would be something like, in order to have coherence about one datum of knowledge, one true proposition, that has to be related inferentially to all of the other propositions in the system. That is one way, there are many ways, of getting toward the idea of a coherence theory of truth. And on pages 158, 153, Matheson does say that Van Til held to a coherence theory of truth as a consequence of his holist epistemology. After quoting Van Til, Matheson says this: "It is evident from this quote why idealism tended to be tied to a coherence theory of truth rather than a correspondence theory," page 153. After quoting Van Til, Matheson says further, "What this ultimately means, according to Ewing, is that reality is a unity of a type of something that's postulated by the coherence theory, and we are near to Bradley's conclusion. We could know no one thing fully without knowing everything else also. Having traced Van Til's theory of knowledge throughout his system of thought, it is abundantly clear that there is propositional influence of idealism here." What is here? The coherence theory of knowledge. Now, let's gut it of the developmental, and let's just see what Van Til says about standard textbook coherence theories of truth. Let me give you a statement, and then I'll just read two quotations from Van Til because we're getting low on time. Van Til denied explicitly both the idealist coherence theory of truth and the realist correspondence theory of truth as traditionally presented. However, he used the terms with new meaning to express a reformed theory in light of the fully self-conscious triune God. But as historically conceived, Van Til held neither to a coherence theory of truth or knowledge, or a correspondence theory of truth or knowledge, simpliciter. Quote, SCE 3, Survey of Christian Epistemology, page 3. "Whether we call our position a correspondence theory or whether we call it a coherence theory, we have in each case to distinguish it sharply from the theories that have historically gone by these names. Accordingly, the determining factor must be a consideration of that which is most fundamental in our theory of correspondence or of coherence. Now, this depends upon the question whether we have God's knowledge in mind first of all, or whether we begin with human knowledge. For God, coherence is the term that comes first. There was coherence in God's plan before there's any space-time fact to which his knowledge might correspond, or we might correspond to his knowledge. On the other hand, when we think of human knowledge, correspondence is of primary importance. If there be true coherence in our knowledge, there will be correspondence between our ideas of facts and God's ideas of facts. Or rather, we should say our ideas must correspond to God's ideas." And then he says this, quote, this is brass tacks, quote, "We hold that the idealist coherence theory of truth cannot lead to coherence because it omits the source of all coherence, namely God." So let me just give a little conclusion a mini conclusion before we broaden out here. Van Til did not teach that in order for man to know something, he has to know everything. That is the false ideal of Adam in his original sin, which Van Til rejected entirely. Van Til did not take isolated and atomistic truths from idealism, whether internal relations, epistemological holism, or an idealist conception of coherence, and replant them into the soil of Reformed orthodoxy. There was no propositional influence on Van Til in these specific areas, as Matheson claims. Van Til rejected traditional coherence and correspondence views. And so what this means is that Matheson's work here, while there's much value in it, and while we've cited things that we appreciate, when it comes to this issue of the influence of idealism, Matheson has either misunderstood Van Til, British absolute idealism, or most unfortunately, both. Doesn't mean the critique has no value in other places or the work has no value in other places, but it means that sadly, Matheson's central reason, it appears to me, for rejecting Van Til's theology and apologetic isn't founded in the primary sources, either of Van Til or of the idealists. And so I think that perhaps a better strategy, if we want to try to understand Van Til's critique of idealism, perhaps, would be if we start with Van Til's orthodox doctrine of God, his orthodox doctrine of man, his orthodox doctrine of covenant, his orthodox doctrine of sin, his orthodox doctrine of Christ, and look at how Van Til applies those orthodox doctrines to all forms of correlativism. Whether it's the theological correlativism of Karl Barth or the philosophical correlativism of idealism. And when we do that, I think we put ourselves in a better position, hopefully, to encourage Dr. Matheson to reassess these mistaken starting points and inferences about the propositional influence of idealism on Van Til, and that maybe that discussion could be advanced if we maybe if we move beyond some of the misguided scholarship from the early 90s on which Dr. Matheson has depended, misguided scholarships from Vantilians who misconstrue that relation, and let Van Til speak more clearly than that scholarship does, more directly, and we understand in a much more comprehensive way how Van Til interfaces with all forms of correlativism, including idealism. I think that puts us on a better path. What do you brothers think?
Yeah, I mean, if I were just to sum up my own positive construction, it's that Van Til so wonderfully recognized this is my father's world, that God is absolute and personal and triune, and he reveals himself and all that he's made. And because he has designed human knowing to be interrelated, and most especially to be related to his own unique, unshareable omniscience, the idea of propositional influence, of individual true teachings from a comprehensive philosophy done in a grand manner from a pagan perspective, propositional influence is impossible. Now there's, again, more to say about common grace and formal truth, but I agree with you. If this is the mouth of the river of critique, I hope what we've said here is helpful to the listener.
I very much appreciate it. I am encouraged, first off, that there's a desire to work with Van Til according to primary sources, that there's a published work, and this is what publishing's all about, that we put things out so that we can have interaction and that people can engage in scholarly dialogue and critique. So I'm thankful very much for that. And I'm thankful also for opportunities like this podcast, where 20 years ago, these kinds of things didn't exist. You're definitely not going to hear something like this on the radio or on television. And so I'm thankful that we have opportunity to speak in a way and to do the work, careful work over the couple weeks of reading, and then put something out. It doesn't have to wait 6 to 12 months to come out in a journal or something like that, or at some sort of conference. At the same time, we recognize that this is an ongoing conversation, and we would encourage further dialogue and discussion. So I encourage that, and hopefully we can have more episodes of Van Til Group here, our little subset of Christ the Center, where we can pick back up with some of those other topics you mentioned, Carlton. I very much look forward to speaking about common grace and the antithesis. For what it's worth, if people are interested in those subjects and would like a positive treatment and a very accessible one, you can check out our fellowship in Reformed Apologetics. Lane has recorded 8 video courses through Reformed Forum, our Reformed Academy. They're all available on our website and on YouTube entirely for free. So if you'd like to see what Lane's position is and what our position is, we agree with them that this is an accurate presentation of Van Til's theology and apologetics. You can find it online at reformedforum.org. Go browse courses. You'll find all the stuff under apologetics, and companion books for each of those courses are on their way. We have one for the second course already, because that started as Van Til, as Lane's dissertation on Van Til, Van Til's Trinitarian Theology. But I'm just working with finalizing the typeset edition of the first book in the series. So if you'd like an introduction to Van Til, a very accessible one that covers all the bases and is a prelude to further advanced study, then that's coming very soon. So we're very excited about that. So brothers, I appreciate your time, and thank you for not only speaking with us today on the program, but for all the research you've done in advance, and look forward, everyone, to further episodes on this and potentially even some opportunities on our Reform Forum live stream. We hope perhaps even to entertain questions in the live stream chat and interact with some of this. So stay tuned at reformforum.org and subscribe to the newsletter, and we'll have information about all that stuff up and available. All right. Well, with all that being said, I'll close things off. I do want to thank everybody for listening and for watching. And we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.